Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We have our interview with Sheriff Mack today. So I really don't have any time. There's no pussyfooting around. We got 30 seconds to basically introduce what's going to happen. And I actually had to cut into the conversation because it went way too long. I tried to cut it off sooner, but anyway, some things have to go their own volition. So I had to do some editing. So we're going to go straight into the middle of a story. And I'll give you the details on that story in our next episode as kind of a follow-up or down the road here, just so you kind of understand the background of why he's telling this story. But we're going to go, as soon as we go out of this bumper music, we're coming right back into the break. And then after that, we'll have another outgoing and we'll have one promo and that is it. So please stay tuned. You're going to love this interview. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
And I ended up in the city clerk's office. And I'm just standing there. And she says, Officer Mack, can I help you? And I said, yeah. And I blurted something out that I have no idea why, because I'd never heard anybody ever talk about this. So I guess somebody else was prodding me. I don't know why I said this. But I said, when I took this job, did I swear an oath? And because I guess that was something that they referred to us as sworn personnel. Because citizens who worked in, like, the records department, they were not sworn personnel. The dispatchers were not sworn personnel. They didn't swear an oath. I never really knew what the difference was, but maybe that was the only place I'd ever heard that term, so maybe that's why I asked it, but I don't know. I don't know why I asked it. And she said, well, yes, you did. And she said, you signed it. And I said, I did? I didn't even remember signing it. So she made me a copy of it and handed it to me, and I read it. And it said, I, Richard I. Mack, solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully uphold, defend, and obey the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the State of Utah, because that's where I worked at the time, and will, to the fullness of my ability, protect, defend, and observe, and do this all to the best of my ability, so help me God. And so I read that, and I was so dismayed and ashamed of myself that I had taken an oath that I had never read or studied. And I said, man, I am a hypocrite and a liar. I took an oath that I never intended to keep. I never tried to learn what it really meant. I just took it to get a job, and I was going to go quit. I'm dead serious. I'm literally going to turn in my badge and my gun and my belt, every right then and there.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
What year was this?
It was 1982.
Interesting. Okay, keep going.
I started in 1979. And so I was heading across the lobby into the police department from the city side offices. And I stopped for a moment and I said, what is my wife going to say when I walk home when I was just supposed to be starting my shift? And then I'm going to tell her, well, I just quit my job. And I kind of had this argument with my wife, you know, how wives can become your conscience after a while.
Yep.
And so I'm having this argument with her about how I couldn't keep my job, and I just couldn't keep a job where I had to lie to be a part of the job, and I couldn't keep my basic fundamental oath. And she said to me, and this was pretty real, but it's still just in my mind.
Right, okay.
And she says, so you're not going to keep your job because it kind of forces you to be a liar and a hypocrite. And I said, yeah, that's it. I'll get another job, I promise. We'll be fine. The kids will be fine. I can do a lot of things. I'm still really young. And she says, well, wait a minute. Would you consider doing one thing for me? And I said, of course, of course. You know, you're in control here. And she says, could you consider just maybe keeping your job and stop being a liar and a hypocrite? And I said, oh, you mean like repent and change? And she says, yeah. And I said, what a great idea. Man, I'm glad I married you. And I've told her about this since then, but I obviously she wasn't even there. And you see how ladies are, GR?
Yep.
Ladies win the argument, and they're not even there. So I decided to keep my job, and I put my badge back on my shirt, and I went down to briefing. And then after I went to briefing, I got in my police car and drove home. And there's the pretty little blonde girl that I married. And she says, what are you doing? I said, before I start my shift, I'm getting the World Book Encyclopedia, because no one had ever given me a pocket-sized constitution at that time. And I got the World Book Encyclopedia that my grandmother sold us. And I got the U.S. Constitution out, and I kept it in my patrol car for about a week. And I studied the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
Then I started studying the Founding Fathers, and I fell in love with all of it. And then in a few weeks, a notice came on the bulletin board in the briefing room, and it said, Constitutional Studies for Law Enforcement. And the instructor was Dr. W. Cleon Skousen. And the state of Utah actually made this training session part of ongoing training. It was post-certified. Peace Officer Standards and Training, it was certified as ongoing training for police certification. Well, I attended that. I went to it. I had to take, normally you can do that on duty because it's police training. But my chief said that he didn't want to send anybody to it. And I said, why do we put up a notice that we don't want to send anybody to for training? So I took 2 days off and went to the training on my own time. And that's very much unheard of. But it was the best training I've ever been to. And while I was there, I was converted to the Constitution. And I was sitting there, and I took another oath. And I promised myself that I would never be on the wrong side again. And I saw a movie about 10 years after this called Braveheart. And Robert De Bruce said that very same line to his father. I will never be on the wrong side again. And wow. So then I continued to study the Constitution. I got a reputation as the constitutional cop in the department. And nobody was really derogatory, meaning it, but I got some teasing about it. And I then became a detective and a sergeant. And in 1987, my wife's parents kept calling me and her and begging me to move home to Arizona and run for sheriff. And it was the furthest thing from my mind. I already had 11 years in it with Provo PD, and I had no intention of moving. I can retire in 9 years. And then I said, and they kept saying, especially her mom, no, we got to have you. You got to come. We're going to get a real horrible, corrupt sheriff if you don't get here, and you got to come and save us. I said, I haven't even lived there for 12 years. I've never worked there in law enforcement. The only job I ever had is I was assistant manager at a local grocery store. And that was when my wife and I were first married, and I was working my way through college. And then I stopped going to school and just worked for a year. And we did it. We ended up just doing it. And I don't know why. And one day I just turned to my wife and I said, we're going to move home and run for sheriff.
And
neither one of us wanted to. Not right. My wife, not me. And one day it just hit me that that's what we were going to do.
So what year was this?
Pardon me?
Do you know what year this was?
Oh, yeah. This was 1987.
Okay.
And so we moved home. And a few months later, I filed for Graham County Sheriff. And it was a very hotly contested primary against, and at the time, I actually ran as a Democrat. I don't care about politics. I don't care about party. But in my county, it was 6-1 Democrat. And I just said, look, even my parents were Democrats. I really don't know why. But the Republican Party was nothing at that time in our county. And most of them voted for all the Republicans, especially the president. The governor was always a Republican, and he always won there. And the president always won there. Nixon did. Reagan did. It was always a Republican county, but everybody was registered Democrat. So it was really kind of crazy. Anyway, I ran as a Democrat. I barely won the primary by 111 votes. And then I beat an eight-year incumbent pretty handily by about 12%. And I became the sheriff of Graham County. And my first day in office was January 1st, 1989. I loved the job. It was amazing. And then I was reelected in 1992. And my wife and I often spoke about what a miracle it was that I was ever elected. And my mom mentioned it once or twice here and there, but my wife and I talked about it frequently. Why the miracle? And, and then one day she and I were kind of channel surfing on the television, and we saw Bill Clinton. This was November of 1993, and he used 13 pens to sign the Brady Bill into law. And we were just kind of wondering how dumb, and all Bill Clinton was to us was entertainment. I thought he was very entertaining with all his scandals and all his lying, and it was just funny to me. And I never really took him seriously about anything except that he was entertaining. And then I didn't think anything else about the Brady Bill until January 21st, 1994. And there were three agents of the BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, who came to our Sheriff's Association meeting in Phoenix. And they presented us with a 25-page document that detailed what our marching orders were in order to comply with the Brady Bill provisions and its enforcement. This is the first time in American history where Congress promulgates a law, the president signs it into law, and then they commandeer the office of sheriff for federal bidding and demand that we enforce it. And not only do they demand that we enforce it, they threaten to arrest us if we failed to comply. And people think I make that up, but it's all true. It's all documented. It's in the Brady Bill, and I've written a little booklet that reviews all of that called The Victory for State Sovereignty that reviews the case, so on and so forth. But anyway, that's getting ahead of myself a little bit.
Okay.
In this amazing, miraculous story. And so when the BATF is explaining what we have to do to comply with the Brady Bill, I was the youngest sheriff in the state at the time. I just got reelected a year before that, and I'm just saying, you know what? But all the sheriffs were really cussing at this. They were really upset about it. They were really upset with the BATF. And I just said, do you guys know that the sheriff doesn't work for the federal government and the Congress and the president can't tell the sheriff what to do? Yeah, they can because they made this law. And I said, that law has no validity because you can't pass a law that you don't have authority to pass. And I said, I don't care if you pass 500 laws. I still do not work for you. The president and the Congress cannot tell any of us in this room. They cannot tell any sheriff what to do. We don't work for you. We work for the people of our county. They elect us. They pay our salary. You can't fire me. You can't hire me. So why would I do something that you tell me to do? And so everybody was looking at me like, well, guy, you don't know what you're talking about. So then at the end of the day, they went around the table asking all the sheriffs what they wanted to do, and I was the only one that said, I'm not going to do it. Everybody else was cussing up a storm, saying how they hated it, how the federal government was so arrogant, and I just said, I'm not going to do it. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not going to do it. And they said, well, what are you going to do, wait till they arrest you? There's a threat of arrest if you don't do it. I said, yeah, I know, and I'm going to have to figure that out. So nobody really took me seriously. But I had a 2.5-hour drive, and by the time I got to my house, it hit me. I was going to sue my own government. And it scared me because here now I'm going to sue Bill Clinton, who I did not trust at all. And the person I knew that was going to be defending it would be Janet Reno, and I trusted her even less. And between the two of them, I trusted them more than I trusted Hillary, and I was afraid Hillary was maybe going to get involved in it. But, you know, you sue Bill, you're suing Hillary and all the Clintons and all the corrupt politicians in Congress, and it really scared me.
Right.
I was scared. I was sweating when I went into the house and told my wife. She was, you know, I hadn't been home for a day and a half because we were in meetings in Phoenix. And she came up to hug me, and I just blurted it out. I didn't hug her or anything. I just said, I'm going to sue the Clinton administration, and they're trying to get me and force me to do the Brady Bill, and it's gun control. I can't do gun control. I took an oath to the Constitution. I can't do this. And I really hope you'll support me. And she goes, oh, yeah, I don't know anything what you're talking about, she said. I said, I get that. So I tried to take another minute and explain it to her. She goes, I still don't understand what you're talking about, but I understand you. And she goes, you know what? Maybe now we know why you were elected sheriff.
Uh-huh.
And so that really hit me. I felt like it was a spiritual manifestation to me. And it was, of course, through my wonderful, beautiful, sensitive wife. And normally my wife wouldn't want me to do stuff like that.
Right.
She would be too concerned about our five children, and she just wouldn't want me to put a target on my back and say, yeah, here, everybody, come and get me.
Oh, absolutely.
She totally supported me.
Mm-hmm.
And on February 28, 1994, the very day the Brady Bill took effect, my lawyers and the entity that was really helping us the most, I called the NRA. I was not a member of the NRA. And I asked him for some advice, and their legal counsel by the name of Richard Gardner told me that they had already been preparing the case to go to federal court, but that they needed a sheriff to call, and I was the first one to call. And they actually said, we've been praying that you would call. So I called, and we started to get going, and they had the case already, and I hired my own lawyer and the NRA lawyers in federal district court in Tucson, filed Mack versus U.S. in federal district court in Tucson, Arizona, in the courtroom of John M. Roll.
Right.
And the next 2.5 years was like the most extreme roller coaster ride of my life.
So let me ask you this, if I can, because we only have 47 minutes. So you were sheriff until when? What was the last year you served as sheriff?
I left office January 1st. 1997, I lost my third election, and it was mostly because of this.
Right, absolutely.
People were upset about it, even though it's a very strong Second Amendment community. I became a big fish in a small pond. I got a lot of notoriety, press, and people said, oh, he's always gone. He just wants to be an activist. He just goes to Washington, D.C. all the time. And all that was not true, and I actually put an ad in the paper from a journal that I kept as sheriff. I kept a personal and sheriff journal of everywhere I was, who I spoke to, what I was doing, because I just really thought it would come back to bite me someday if I didn't have that documented. And so I put every place where I'd been and all the time I'd been in the county, and I put an ad in the paper, if anybody can disprove this, I'll pay you $5,000 reward. And, of course, nobody did because the lies about me were working. And the only deputy I ever fired, and he got fired because he helped manipulate some evidence and destroy some evidence for his sister who got arrested on a drug deal. And I thought everybody knew about it, and I didn't think anybody would want him. But it was just a good old boy system there. And the people who did know about it didn't care, and then other people didn't know it. And people were just kind of mad at me, and it was mostly over the Brady Bill, and I became a big fish in a small pond, and people didn't like that. And so, anyway, I was kicked to the street when I was 44 years old, and my wife and I felt that we were going to go on to bigger and better things, and I started touring the country on the lecture circuit and started writing books and ran for a couple of times a Congress that didn't really work out very well, but It just was an amazing miracle that this small town boy has authored 7 or 8 books now, and been on the lecture circuit, and I don't think anybody's been to more Tea Party rallies to speak than I have. I don't think Sarah Palin or anybody else has been to more of them. I did about 135, and I'm still doing some. But now I teach school, and I do the CSPUA full-time, and your original question finally got to this. My organization, the CSPOA, the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, was born out of my lawsuit and my concern that we do not keep a sacred oath that we are required by Article 6 of the Constitution to take. And the supreme law of the land says we will swear an oath of allegiance to the United States Constitution, and it requires each of us in all three branches of government to swear that oath, because the founding fathers determined that if all public officials in all three branches of government have the same ultimate paramount goal of protecting God-given liberty via the Constitution, then that will perpetuate the Constitution and individual liberty forever. And so that is why they put it in there, and that is why we're supposed to take that oath. And I was so disappointed in my time in law enforcement and police work that there was no one keeping their oath, no one training as far as what the Constitution meant or the oath meant, how significant it was to our jobs and to our people. And there was no one paying any attention to the Declaration of Independence, where it said that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. No one did that. No one knew what it meant to, when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right and it is the duty of the people to throw off such government and establish new guards. No one thought, if you ever said that to anybody in government, they would think you were guilty of sedition. And yet you're doing exactly, just quoting exactly what the Declaration of Independence says. And so I was really disappointed. I was really dismayed, and I believe that most cops and sheriffs and people in public service were all what I thought I was, liars and hypocrites. They don't care about their oath. They don't obey the oath, and they're not even concerned whether they obey it or not. Most even say they don't have to keep their oath. Most of them make up excuses as to why they don't have to keep their oath. I know that at the very least, not keeping that sacred oath is perjury. And I believe that it could reach the level of treason.
Right, right. So let me ask you this. So you retired as sheriff, and I understand you went into teaching and had these other things, but you founded the CSPOA. Shortly
in 2010.
After, in 2010 is when you actually organized it as a, 501c3?
It hasn't been until just now. We're just finishing the paperwork to get the 501c3. Up till now, it hasn't been one.
So what is it
and
now?
I didn't at first want to, and then so many people have asked, because we want to donate to you, but we also want it to be tax deductible. And I said, well, I hate the IRS, and I hate the tax system. They go, yeah, we do too. But we need it, and so I've talked it over with staff, and everybody just kind of said, yeah, you might want to compromise and do it. So I've decided to go ahead and do it, but I don't like it.
So are you an LLC right now then?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so personally, I'm an LLC, just as my publishing and so forth. I'm not trying to create an organization. I don't know if I've ever told you that, but it now's not about me. It's about you. And so... So in 2010, you created the CSPOA and started gaining this traction of, you know, taking the front line in every county and getting sheriffs to become focused on the Constitution and understanding their oath and so forth. And actually, let me ask you this. Are you aware of... I asked you, and I've actually finished writing my last article regarding Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And I think I mentioned that to you. Did you get a chance to actually read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, I did.
And so your thoughts?
Well, I think it has some applicability. I thought it was kind of confusing, some of it.
It's very confusing.
I didn't think it was as specific relating to what you had theorized or your thesis, that it actually provided a punishment to those who didn't, who would not keep their oath. It certainly seemed to dance around that.
Well,
but
so,
I didn't think it was as specific as what you had brought up.
No. So, yeah, it's not a punishment. It is... What they did with Section 3 is they created a qualification standard, because I pulled out all 263 pages out of the Congressional Globe where the 14th Amendment was discussed in Congress, and the history on this, and I don't want to take up too much time. In 1866, they passed a bill. It was the first civil rights bill ever. And the intent was to protect the freedmen. And then they realized that they were applying a bill that they had no enumerated powers over. So they said, you know what? Even though President Johnson vetoed it and they overrode his veto, they knew they needed constitutional force. So they actually went back and they immediately worked on the 14th Amendment. And in just a matter of a few months, they actually produced the 14th Amendment. And during the discussion, Senator Howard from Michigan, because one of the questions in the Senate, and well, let me back up real quick. In the House, as they discussed this, Section 3 really was, the intent of Section 3 was just to punish anybody that participated in the rebellion in the South up until 1870. So it was going to give them like a 4-year harsh punishment that they couldn't hold office. And Senator Howard changed that to eliminate any expiration date. And he changed the tone instead of it being a punishment, because bottom line, that part of the Constitution would have been a conflict and a violation in the Constitution, because in Article 1, Section 9, this federal government cannot pass ex post facto laws. And that technically was going to be an ex post facto law that they would be now punishing something that didn't exist when it was legal before.
They pass ex post facto laws all the time.
Absolutely. I know that. And my listeners are very aware of the dangers and the prevalence in our system today. But the bottom line is that when it went into the Senate actually completely changed the tone to where, this is how I summarize this for people. If you read Section 3, it basically goes like this. No person shall be, and they list all these offices, shall be a public servant who, as an officer of, takes an oath to support the Constitution. And no public servant who has, and I'm just, again, if you do the dot dots over these explanations of all these different types of people, no public servant, while they're in office or have served in office, and it is proved that they have violated the Constitution by supporting rebellion or insurgency or outright violations of the Constitution, are eligible to be in office or ever hold office. They're to be removed and to be banned for life. So what this is not a criminal crime. They've created a standard of qualification. So in other words, there's no due process. It's not like you're going to be tried and go to jail. You're not going to be deprived of your life and or liberty, only your ability to sit in office.
Which I totally agree with that. I think that anyone in violation of their oath should never be allowed to be in public office again. I agree with that totally. In fact, I've even said that before I understood that part of the Constitution.
Right, right, okay.
And I totally agree with that. But I've got to tell you, the CSPOA was founded from my own dismay that we in law enforcement, we in public service, we as peacekeepers and peace officers did not keep our oath, know anything about the oath. And I understand that people that, are innocently ignorant of that, mm-hmm. because I was, mm-hmm. and so I'm still kind of patient. A lot of people just are mad at cops and, let's arrest anybody who doesn't keep their oath, and I said, you know what, you would have arrested me within the first 2.5 years of my public service, and as a cop.
Right, right.
And I finally discovered the truth, and I've never gone back. But we got to give these people time to discover this, because they're part of a culture that doesn't learn about the Constitution or care about the Constitution. And so the CSPOA, the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, was founded out of that problem that I had. And what I saw in government, I looked at the Constitution on one hand and saw what we did in government on the other, and I saw very little similarity.
Right, right.
And there wasn't even a pretense to support the Constitution, and including the Bill of Rights. And one of the biggest things I questioned was, why do we have an IRS, and why do we let them commit so many crimes? And why doesn't anybody do anything about it?
Right.
The comments and the responses there. What, are you crazy? That's what we've always done, right?
No, actually.
Don't you know how things are done?
Right. If you've read that article that I wrote, What is the Real Problem? It puts it into context that at the very beginning, when the federal government created a tax, it was the distilling tax that they put on, you know, distilled liquors, that they were going to start taxing that. And the Whiskey Rebellion was a direct rebellion or an insurrection. Actually, it was more of a protest, and they wouldn't have any of it. I mean, Washington got on his horse, mustered the militia, and they went out and enforced that law. And I believe they arrested 24 people, two of which were actually tried and convicted of treason. And so they took it very seriously. But the fact of the matter is, they didn't create the IRS. They already had within the instrument, within the Constitution, a mechanism of enforcement, which was literally we the people. Because if you understand the militia, that is we the people from the organized and unorganized
True.
Militia. And
True.
And so they actually created the precedent. So when people want to go, well, what did they do? I mean, they didn't have an IRS. Well, no, they didn't, because we had a militia, and we're still in the Constitution. The militia is the most valid part of enforcement. There's never been an amendment.
If you read the Constitution, it certainly sounds like it is.
Right. So there's never been an amendment in the Constitution to take away the militia's responsibility and to grant the federal government the ability to enforce their own laws.
Well, it was reinforced when they did the Bill of Rights later in the Second Amendment.
Absolutely.
Mentioned the militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Yes, and
so it was actually necessary
correct.
For freedom.
Yes, in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments.
And that's what I said.
Yes.
And that's why I was so adamant about the lawsuit, because I wanted to protect the Second Amendment.
Right.
But I also found out when I said I wanted to sue on the Second Amendment that I had no standing. I couldn't do it on the Second Amendment, because I was not damaged. My Second Amendment rights were not damaged. And that was kind of a technicality, but they were right. I wasn't, because law enforcement was exempt from the Brady Bill background checks. So I didn't. But I did have damage on the Tenth Amendment, and my decision became, first of all, I want everybody to know, six other sheriffs joined me in the lawsuit. Sheriff Prince from Montana and I ended up the Supreme Court together. Our cases were combined, and it was an amazing, amazing process. The hearing lasted 1 hour at the Supreme Court, and then that was December of 1996, and then on June 27, 1997, about 10 months after I had lost my third election bid, the Supreme Court gave me the biggest victory of my life, and it ruled that the Brady Bill was unconstitutional, where it required local sheriffs to enforce federal law. And it went much broader, much deeper than I ever imagined. And let me tell you, every one of you right now, it is the most powerful Tenth Amendment decision in the history of our country. It's an absolute miracle. Everyone needs to read this book, needs to read the case. I wrote a little booklet about it, a little pocket-sized, same size as your pocket-sized Constitution, and I did a review of the highlights of the case. Everybody needs to get that. You need to pass it around to everybody. You need to pass it around to every citizen that treasures liberty. You need to give it to every public official, every sheriff candidate, every sheriff that's in office. Everybody needs to see it, because it makes one statement in there that makes the whole thing worthwhile. And it's, quote, "But the Constitution protects us from our own best intentions," end quote. And then, GR, you're not going to believe this. It goes even so far as to say it protects us from the crisis, quote, crisis of the day, end quote.
Right.
That we may resist the temptation to concentrate power in one location as an expedient solution to the crisis of the day.
Right.
My friends, can you believe that the United States Supreme Court said something that powerful? But the thing of it is, the Constitution doesn't protect us. It's the people who have sworn an oath to protect and defend and uphold the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't protect us from anything unless we have the people with the guts and the courage to actually enforce it. And so this is how vital it is that we have sheriffs and other public officials who actually keep their oath of office, who keep their word, and put the Constitution first, and put liberty first, because the only real purpose for any government existing is to protect individual liberty and our God-given rights. That's why I formed the CSPOA. That is what we do at the CSPOA, is we awaken everybody in government, especially sheriffs, because they are a very unique position, and to do one simple thing: protect liberty, keep your word, keep your oath. And when other government officials and agents come in and violate the constitutional rights of a citizen in our counties and in our jurisdictions, that we will be found interposing and protecting the people from those types of criminals. So if, let's just say, if the IRS or FDA or EPA or Army Corps of Engineers or FBI or DEA, any of these federal agents, of which there are probably hundreds and more, if they come in and they are violating the rights of the citizen, the sheriff's job is not to refer them to a good attorney. It is his job to stop it, to stand against it, and it is a very peaceful, nonviolent approach. And I'll tell you one thing, we've had dozens and dozens of sheriffs who have taken stands against government, other governments. Sometimes it's local and state, or sometimes it's federal. Every single time that sheriffs, including myself, which I'm not talking about the Brady Bill now, I'm talking about when I stood up to the EPA and Army Corps of Engineers, every single time we have it documented, when these sheriffs have done that, they have won every time. They win. And I guarantee you that the federal government and federal agents do not want to fight with sheriffs.
So let me, if you don't mind, I have a unique perspective regarding the Constitution, because I truly believe that the Constitution actually does protect us from illegitimate governments. The problem is when the people, either through complacency, illiteracy, through just dumbfoundedness, or through the maniacal machinations of self-aggrandizing politicians, lawyers, bankers, whatever, convince the people that they have all the authority. Because see, that this is, you know, when you really, because I've analyzed how we got into this mess, and a good friend of mine.
But still, the Constitution cannot do it. It's people. It's as, the Constitution's only as strong as the people whose hands are there to protect it.
Well, so I'll give you a case in point. We have a government that about 90, I don't know the exact percentage, but probably about 90% of what the federal government, people that are being paid by the federal government, are doing unconstitutional work.
Exactly.
And
totally.
So the Constitution, because of the mechanism that it requires for an Article 5 amendment for a new power, role, or responsibility to be delegated to the federal government formally, it does protect itself. It just requires a wake-up for the people to say, look, where did we delegate these powers? Because Madison stated this in 1817 during the bonus bill veto. He says, regardless if the states even allow you to do this unconstitutionally, it is still unconstitutional at any point in time. The states can actually pull the rug out from underneath us. And in his...
Well, yeah, and what you said, some people have got to enforce this. It's just like you almost quoted him. Thomas Jefferson said, you cannot be ignorant and free. And that's where we are. We're either complacent or we don't care, or we're running an agenda of political correctness that completely destroys the Constitution.
Right.
But if you see and look at these sheriffs who are standing now, it's because they are standing for the Constitution that we have hope. And it is an amazing promise and contract that if we will abide by the Constitution, if we will enforce it, if we will uphold it, it says in the oath, uphold, defend. And in the Utah oath, it actually said obey. If we put that into practice, instead of just talking about it and taking an oath, we will protect it, and we will uphold the Constitution. It can't uphold itself.
So let me ask.
And I know those are somatic.
No, that's okay. But
it takes work, right, and it takes effort from people who have made that promise to our constituents that will protect their liberty. And that's why I'm so proud of these sheriffs that we have now telling their governors and mayors, I'm not going to enforce your dictatorial orders. I'm not going to make this a police state. I will not allow my county to be a police state. We will not act like Nazi soldiers. And I right now, I want everybody to get behind that movement, because we actually have sheriffs who have proven to the American people that this is a peaceful and effective solution. And that's why I really want to get going on this even more than I have before. And this is the busiest I've ever been, because people are starting to see the truth, and we're having constitutional sheriffs pop up all over the country.
Okay, so I've just got a couple more minutes, but this kind of begs the question. As a sheriff, you are to faithfully execute the laws and ensure that the Constitution is being supported. Your counterpart at the county level would be the state the county commissioners and or supervisors, correct?
Correct.
And so they're the sovereigns of the county, correct? And so by definition,
I kind of like to try to call the people the sovereigns of the county, but they are the executors of some of the ordinances of the county. So yeah, I've never used that term sovereign. I have to think about that.
Well,
I don't know how sovereign they are, because they're only there because the people elected them and put them there.
Well,
and sovereignty, I think you're kind of born with, and it's always there.
So I can explain this, because the
sovereignty sovereign means no higher authority above you.
That's right.
People are above
Absolutely.
The county commissioner.
Absolutely. And if you understand a Republican form of government, in a Republican
right.
form of government, you delegate very specific powers to the county commissioners, to your state
Correct.
Legislators, to Congress. In our form of Republican form of government, the sovereigns within a Republican form of government are those lawmakers who you've delegated power. And over those matters, they are sovereign. They're the last say over the powers delegated. And if you don't like the outcome of the laws that they've created with the powers you've given them, then you have to vote them out. Right. You vote them away. And so, and then you have to do some cleaning. Well, folks, we got a lot of cleaning to do.
All right. Okay. So, all right. So you call them sovereign. It might be semantics, but I don't think it's a major deal. What's your point on that?
Well, so in the county relationship, because I recognize that the county commissioners have, I truly believe that they've just been neutered. They don't understand their role in this fight as well as the sheriff. They seem to be more of the lapdogs of the Agenda 21, the lobbyists, and this what's going on at the state. And they're just looking at the shinier object of maybe I can get a position here or do this, you know, and leave the county behind. And I'm going, you know, these guys are absolutely clueless. And it seems
or they can get grants and they can get okay, yeah, I agree with all that.
And so I honestly think that one of the things that was missing in as we matured as a society, and I'm just going down this, you know, this pie in the sky type of thing, I think that one of the things that was missing in our county government is that we didn't identify like a governor or a true executive. Not that the sheriff doesn't play that role, but the sheriff's, his scope and jurisdiction is limited within the county. And having an executive, and I'm just, you know, theoretically throwing this out there, getting this, you know, to be thrown at the wall here. A sheriff is the enforcer of the law, but the executive...
Well, it depends on what you're calling law.
Well, so the county laws, as well as the state laws, as well as the U.S. laws, as long as they're congruent with the constitutions.
Well, that's the biggest question right there, yeah, which right. Very few of them are.
No, I get that. But I think that counties really lack the ability to coordinate, you know, just like governors kind of coordinate and work out trade deals or work out, you know, opportunities to grow their state. And there's that lack, I think, in counties where counties have been really relegated by municipalities. And that's what ends up happening is, like, if you look at Phoenix, Arizona, how Phoenix has kind of grown and how many counties does it span now? And it kind of controls those counties. And that was never the intent. As a matter of fact, when the framers talked about the framework of the state, you know, militias were broken down into the counties. Everything was broken down by the county. And they, one of the things that they guarded us against was population centers from controlling us. Their intent was to ensure that the minority could never be oppressed by the majority. And look at today. I mean, we are totally being oppressed by the majority of those in population centers in populated states. And they want to force us down this path. I just had this great conversation with Trevor Lawton. But anyway, I digress. I was just, you know, throwing out this concept that, you know, the sheriff has a very integral role within government. If you understand the three sides of government, maybe the sheriff, because he is technically in law enforcement, maybe the sheriff should be moved either as an executive or we create an executive and the sheriff basically reports to...
Well,
does that make sense?
Called him the top executive of the county.
Yes.
And if you go back through the history of the sheriff being here, three of the founding fathers were actually, who signed the Declaration of Independence, were actually former sheriffs. And it was the only law enforcement really there, but a lot of people get mad at the term law enforcement. They just want it to be peacekeeping or the... Delaware Constitution, the first state of the 13 original states, Delaware was first, and their state constitution said that the sheriff was the conservator of the peace for each county, even though Delaware only had three counties.
Mm-hmm.
But the plain and simply, it is this. The sheriff is the protector of the county, is the protector of the people. When it comes to their individual God-given rights, they delegated that to him. And they can take that back away from him because every 4 years they do a review of his job performance and they take it back.
Right.
So they really are the sovereigns of that. It's by, for, and of the people, literally. And they choose who their sheriff is and they choose who the county commissioners are. And I don't believe that we get to throw off despotic government because we vote every 4 years or every 2 years. I believe that we have much more power than that. I'm not sure who or how we define that, but I know it comes up within the militia itself, and the sheriff has the authority to call out the militia in the county. And I think it's a very, very powerful position that most sheriffs don't even know or understand. But I do... know this, that the supreme law of the land that the sheriff has sworn an oath to uphold and defend is the Constitution, and even before that, it would be God's law, and the freedom and liberty that we received when we were born and our natural rights are what are supposed to be protected the most. And so I pray we can get back to that. I am doing everything I can to put that back at the top of the agenda for our nation's sheriffs.
Right. So,
and I believe that we're making progress on that, and I believe that if we would focus on that, we could really make a lot of headway in restoring our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, county by county, one sheriff at a time.
Right. So What I'd like to do is have you back on, because I understand the fundamental focus on the Constitutional Sheriffs Peace Officers Association, and it seems very parallel, and I know this probably other people kind of compare Oath Keepers and yourself kind of at the same line. And but I do believe, as we were just talking about, I do believe that the oath of office and Section 3 of the 14th Amendment are critical keys from the divine hand of providence. And I believe these are the mechanisms. So I'd like to discuss this further, because I understand the focus of your organization, but I don't believe any public servant who puts their hand to the square and takes the oath of office should be left out. They should all be focused on, and they should all understand their obligation and imperative to understand that if they don't fulfill their oath, that they are going to be removed, like Section 3 basically articulates. But anyway, the other little thing is, and it's sad, that Section 3 has been in the Constitution since 1866, and it is probably the least understood portion. Most of the 14th Amendment is the least understood portion of the Constitution. So,
yeah, and it's too long. The 14th Amendment's too long, and it is complicated.
But I do believe the divine hand of providence gave it to us because He understood, our Creator understood exactly what we would need with the perils we have to face at this time. I want to thank you for your time, folks. We will be right back after this. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
All right, so, excuse me, in less than 30 seconds, that basically summarizes the entire show. We actually had to cut some stuff out, and like I said, I'll give you that information in an upcoming episode. And we're going to be getting into more content and actually preparing you for the ratification debates starting next week. So we really appreciate the fact that Sheriff Mack and Trevor Lawton made themselves available. And more importantly, we appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to dial in and actually listen to these important interviews as well as the content that we're offering. We can't do it without you. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.